winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Well, to paraphrase Simon and Garfunkel, where have you gone, Preet Bharara?
First up, though, we begin the program with our Karen DeWitt, who is with Andrea Miller of the National Institute for Reproductive Health.
Andrea Miller, thanks for joining us on
New
York
Now. Happy
to be here. Now, you've been a longtime lobbyist for NARAL, Pro-Choice New York, but you're doing more of a national role. Can you just explain that briefly before we
Certainly.
Get to the questions?
So the National Institute for Reproductive Health is what emerged from NARAL Pro-Choice New York. Over the years, we started doing much more work, not just in New York, but all across the country. And now, in this sort of brave new world that we're all in, we realize how important it is to place the New York work in a national context. And so that's really what we do now.
Well, it seems like you're going to have quite a busy time in front of you based
yes.
on all that's going on.
Yes.
Do you think that Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion decision, do you think there's a real chance it could be overturned?
Well, I'll say that this moment in time is pretty remarkable in terms of the level of attack. And we know we have a president who has been full-throated in his opposition to Roe v. Wade, who's made it clear that he's going to appoint justices who would eviscerate it, in fact, overturn it. That's a unique moment in time. We've had presidents in the past who have indicated through what their solicitors general have done and what their briefing has done, and also even what they've done in policy, to say they're anathema to it. But they've never said, we are going to make sure that the justices that we appoint overturn Roe versus Wade. And we have a new appointment already on deck.
And speaking of that, Neil
yes.
Gorsuch, President Trump's first choice.
Yes.
You knew him. You were both at college together.
We were.
At Columbia University. You were editor of the school paper, right?
I was. I was the editorial page editor. He was one of the columnists.
Mm-hmm. Conservative.
Quite conservative. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say it is not an understatement to say that then, as now, he was very much outside the mainstream. I think he's tried to portray himself as sort of a intelligentsia around conservative issues back then and now, but the fact is he was really quite hostile to all of the efforts that we were engaged in. This was in the mid-80s. I mean, in some ways, there's a lot of echoes of that right now, mm-hmm. I feel, yeah. in terms
sort
of
the middle of Reaganism, mid-80s,
exactly.
right? Yeah.
And there were so many issues that we were dealing with, and particularly on campus, dealing with how women were being treated. Let's remember, Columbia only went co-ed right before I got there, right
yeah.
before we got there.
So that was like 1986. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so the first co-ed class to graduate was the 1987 class. The last all-male class was the 86 class.
So it was... Some people were uncomfortable with all of a sudden
yes.
all these women.
Yes.
There,
I yeah. mean, so there was a lot around gender on campus. There was a lot around people of color and their treatment on campus. There were real concerns about the frat culture, and he was very much involved in that and an apologist in some ways for some of that bad behavior or for those institutions.
Well, is there anything particularly memorable that he said that you remember
well,
or
he
encounters
really...
that you had with him?
So
I mean,
we
was
had
he
a...
nice? Did you get along?
You know, it's funny because I had two hats when I dealt with him, right? One hat was as an activist on campus. Mm-hmm. And we were really completely, could not have been at more polar opposites. Mm-hmm. There was a little kerfuffle where he was concerned that his Federalist paper, newspaper, had been outed for getting funding from the Heritage Foundation.
Mm-hmm. And the conservative group, yes. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And thought that... And certainly I was one of the people who had the information and shared it on, and he started to threaten to sue, which was actually, I mean, in retrospect, you sort of laugh at that. But for someone who was on student aid, who couldn't afford to be challenged in any way, mm-hmm. it was sort of terrifying. Then my other hat was as the editorial page editor, and I felt it was critical that dissenting voices, including his, be there. But the tenor of what he wrote, the dismissiveness about efforts to deal with the frat system, to deal with sexual assault on campus, to address racial attacks, the dismissiveness really was concerning.
But granted, everybody was really young then. It was a long time ago. You know, people do grow up. Are there any conclusions we can draw from this? Do you think he's, growing as everybody, we hope everybody does over the
decades? We certainly hope everyone does. But I do think that there's a fundamental core of us that doesn't change in terms of where we sort of position ourselves in terms of our value system. And when you look at the decisions he's written, on a range of issues, I have deep concerns that he's carried through those values and they're really deeply outside the mainstream.
He also has a track record as a judge, because he's been a judge in various capacities.
That's
he sided with Hobby Lobby that denied the employee contraceptive coverage.
Exactly.
He sided with the Utah governor who wanted to defund Planned Parenthood.
That's right.
So what do you,
well,
and he's, what does that say?
He's taken a really extreme position on those things. He's really embraced the idea that this is all about the employers and completely, again, this dismissiveness about the impact on women if their employers deny them access to contraception. That's a really fundamental question, and it just doesn't even raise to the level of his calculus. Some of his other writings, you know, muse about whether what would have happened, say, if the Roe versus Wade decision had not taken the sort of fundamental tact that a woman's right and the right of developing life are not equivalent under the 14th Amendment. That's a fundamental. If you're even willing to question that, that suggests something deeply profound, profoundly different than the current jurisprudence in the court, which is a big concern, because he could be there for a very long time. I consider myself relatively young, although these days I'm feeling old. But
retirement
he could be there
age is getting up, and there's no retirement age for Supreme Court judges, of
that's
course.
That's true. Yes. So he could be there for a very, very long time, and he is Scalia plus in some ways, just not with the sort of intensity of his language. He comes across more soft-spoken than a Justice Scalia, but he's really at that end of the spectrum, if not further.
Well, on to New York State, where you've spent a lot of time in New York State
and
politics.
And continue to,
We have a 1970 law. It was 3 years before Roe
That's
v. Wade,
right.
And it legalizes abortion. So if Roe v. Wade goes away, most people, I think that nothing would really change in that respect with in terms of a right to choose in New York. Whether you agree with that or not, that would be the way it is. Is that law sufficient? Would that cover us?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because the simple answer is no. First thing for people to remember, which I think we haven't been as explicit about, but now it's so critical for people to understand, is in New York, it isn't that abortion is quote-unquote legal, according to the statute. It's a crime with exceptions. And what that means is that when you think about what a Trump, Pence, Gorsuch America could look like, they want abortion to be a crime, and therefore the presumption would be that healthcare providers and women would be engaging in criminal activity and would have to defend against having done so. The current so that's the future.
Yes, so what are the
current
exceptions?
Issues?
If you said a crime,
right? So currently, what it says is that you can a physician can terminate a pregnancy up to 24 weeks, or thereafter if a woman's life is at risk. There is no exception, as is required by the Supreme Court and all the jurisprudence in Roe versus Wade. There's no protection for a woman's health throughout pregnancy, which is solid. Through line since Roe v. Wade has not been shaken whatsoever, and of course is something we'd be really concerned about in the future under someone like Gorsuch and others joining the court. So what that means in real life today is we have women and their families who have to leave New York State if something goes tragically wrong near the end of their pregnancies. If they need to terminate that pregnancy, they frequently cannot do that in New York State.
But that's going on right now.
That is currently happening. I was just at a rally where a woman and her husband spoke about having to travel from Brooklyn to Colorado recently because they could not get the services that they need here in New York because of the chilling effect of a criminal statute on the books.
So I don't think that's really widely known.
It's not, and I think it's really important because the core here is women are being harmed now, today, because of the deficit in our existing law, and it doesn't provide an affirmative right placed in the public health code where it belongs. It instead sits in the criminal law, and that leaves it open to interpretation. That leaves it up to prosecutors. We've even had a history of a woman in Upper Manhattan being prosecuted for trying to terminate her own pregnancy several years ago. Now, thankfully, that was dropped, but still, it means that the means are there for overzealous prosecutors. When you think about the signaling effect from the White House, from the federal government right now, for those to go to the extreme, that's deeply troubling, and all the reason we need to pass the Reproductive Health Act now.
And that's been there a while. It would codify Roe v. Wade. Former
that's
Governor
right.
Elliot Spitzer started it.
Right.
Governor Andrew Cuomo supported it. But the Republican led state Senate doesn't want to do it. That's a sticking point.
Right.
And they say they think it's too radical, it goes too far. They portray it as though you could get an abortion up to, you know, a day before you give birth,
and they feel like that is... Which is the usual. That's the usual. I mean, that's what people claim about Roe versus Wade, and that is simply not the case. The reality is, I think that the state Senate leadership needs to come clean with the people of New York. Let this bill come to the floor. Be honest about it. Vote. If that's your view, then vote that way. But let it see the light of day. Bring it to the floor, because I firmly believe that there is a majority in this state house, especially today, especially given what's happening in D.C., in the federal government. There will be enough votes. And if there aren't, then the voters of New York deserve to know exactly where every state senator stands. Because this is a moment in time that is unparalleled in terms of the attacks on women's access to reproductive health care, including abortion. And for our state Senate leadership to say, we're going to play the old game, we're going to do business as usual, we're not going to bring this up, it's unconscionable and they shouldn't be allowed to do
it. A good point that you make is they would need Republican votes, because we won't get into the complexities of how the Senate is run right now, but even if the Democrats ran it, I don't think there's enough Democratic votes to get to 32 or something like this you want, you know, a little more than just the bare minimum. So some Republicans would have to come forward. I mean,
they
do you foresee a time of them doing that?
It's a bipartisan issue in New York. If you look at the polling, if you look at the public opinion, it is 70% to 80% support, no matter how you ask the question. And that includes in districts that are, there are a lot of swing districts, you know, the suburban districts, you know, Long Island, the Hudson Valley, and beyond. I mean, there are swing districts upstate. We know that, that go back and forth every cycle. This will be a litmus test question for voters, and they should get on board now. Get it done this year. Get it behind you. And then you can worry about 2018.
Do you think Governor Cuomo should be doing more? If we look back to 2011 and gay marriage, he managed to convince four Republican senators to come over. Granted, I think all of them lost their jobs
eventually they did,
so
right.
Which, you know, makes them a little wary of something like this. But should he be doing more?
He
hasn't said much about
it. I think the governor's on board. The governor wants New York to be a leader in this. I encourage him to continue to be full-throated in his support and to talk to the senators where he can. I mean, he does have power in this situation, and we urge him to continue to use that.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And now we hand it back to the desk.
Time for this week's New York Now poll question. Do you think Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned? Let us know by logging on to our website, nynow.org. Last time we saw you, we asked, do you agree with the decision to close down the Indian Point nuclear power plants? And 63% said yes. Kelly in Mayapak, not far from the plant, told us the overall safety of millions certainly overrides the financial tax breaks, which comes from our pockets, of a few hundred. Dan in Ossining, also in northern Westchester County, said, I strongly agree with the decision to close Indian Point. Yesterday would not have been too soon. However, transition time for those affected is also very important. And finally, Jim in Glenmont disagrees. The need for energy taxes and jobs in New York needed to be protected. More safety efforts could have been enhanced. Thank you to all those who took the time to vote. The website, again, is nynow.org. That's the place where you can catch up on any of our past programs and follow links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. In addition, you'll find a way to the Capitol Confidential blog run by Casey Seiler and his crew at the Capitol. You can also access it by going to timesunion.com. We will play a snippet of a voice. You have to name it. Who is it?
We love public schools.
And our latest podcast is now up. Another edition of our New York State Trivia Contest, this time between Rick Carlin of the Times Union and Bill Mahoney of Politico New York. Again, that can be found at nynow.org. All right, Casey and I are joined at the Reporters Roundtable now by Karen DeWitt. And one interesting nugget from that interview, Karen, is that Andrea Miller was a former college classmate of Neil Gorsuch.
That's right. Who knew how those connections go back? And the funny thing is they're probably both going to be fighting on opposite ends of the spectrum, probably, you know, for their entire lives, which I don't think either of them expected.
That means they must have known each other right when Gorsuch's mother, who was a former EPA administrator, was going through her sort of fall and exit from the federal government during the Reagan years.
I assume so. We didn't get into that, but I'm old enough to remember those days.
Yeah. Now, since we are a weekly wrap-up show, we have to touch on a subject that was huge news last Saturday. Now, we tape on Friday mornings, and sometimes we're victim to late Friday afternoon news dumps. We don't see breaking news happen on a Saturday too often, but that's what happened with Preet Bharara.
And it was sort of a 24-hour cycle, because on Friday afternoon, we learned that more than 40 Obama holdover federal prosecutors had been asked by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, which means by President Donald Trump, to resign, to hand in their resignation letters. Of course, Preet Bharara, back at the end of November, had done this sort of pilgrimage, visit to Trump Tower, mm-hmm. and emerged and told reporters, I spoke with the president-elect, I spoke with, you know, with Sessions, who then was the sort of AG designate, was going to be the nominee, and was asked to stay on. And I told them I'd love to stay on. It's a terrific job. My people do good work. And then, of course, on Saturday, Preet Bharara tweeted out, after, you know, hours and hours of not knowing what his status was going to be, I did not resign. I was fired. Mm.
On his personal account, too, which he just created, in the last week.
Yeah. Huh, so maybe he knew something was coming. I don't think it's a surprise that Donald Trump mm-hmm. changed his mind, but honestly, if we lived in a parallel universe where Hillary Clinton was president, which none of us live in, mm-hmm. I don't think he would have stayed with her, because he didn't pull his punches, and he went after everybody. And there was rumors that he might have gone after the Clinton Foundation. He might have gone after some of Trump's business doings. Certainly, he went after both parties in the state legislature and Governor Cuomo. So everybody was kind of afraid of him. And I think it is going to be a big loss, because nobody's really going to be watching these guys in Albany. And the New York state laws are pretty lax. There's a lot of things that they could probably get away with now if they wanted to, that they wouldn't if they knew that the U.S. attorney, who'd already gotten jail terms for the two major party legislative leaders, was looking at them.
And it's important to note that, at least in the near term, very little is going to change. In other words, the cases that are in the pipeline, including the prosecution of Joe Prococo mm-hmm. and Alain Calleros, the former head of SUNY Poly Institute, that is going to move along.
Nine former Cuomo associates. Yep, that is going along. But do you think it will go as well without Preet Bharara at the helm? I mean, that's kind of a big question there.
Well, but staff, you know, the sort of senior staff at the Southern District office is handling the case now. In other words, Preet Bharara is not going to be in the court. He was never going to be in the courtroom arguing this case. The question that people have now is how robust will the Southern District be going forward? Of course, that's an office that handles Wall Street. Yeah. In addition to all the state government work that we've seen it do, including the fall of Sheldon Silver and the fall of Dean Skelos, both cases brought by Preet Bharara.
And we have no idea who the new U.S. attorney is going to be.
Right, that's the other question. Yeah. It was really remarkable watching him exit the building for the final time. I don't know if you guys saw that, but it was like a hero just leaving mm-hmm. for the final time. People just lined up wanting to shake his hand. That kind of leads us to another story that came out, I believe it was Thursday, with Mayor Bill de Blasio from New York City, who will not be charged. Preet Bharara was looking into some of his activities as well.
That's right. Possible pay-to-play schemes with donors getting favors. He kind of meddled in the 2014 Senate Democratic races, moving money around, possibly in violation of Board of Elections rules. But they said there just wasn't enough evidence to prosecute him, which I think can give the green light once again to other politicians, saying this is how far we can go up to the line and get away with it. Good news for Bill de Blasio, though, because that would have been a big issue, whatever opponents he would have had. Not that many were emerging. Yes, and that's taken off the table.
But there's still bad news for him, because I know Cy Vance, the Manhattan DA, said that it was clear that the activities violated, at least at the very least, the spirit and intent mm-hmm. of the campaign finance law. So he skates away. De Blasio skates away from the threat of prosecution. But there is definitely going to be a political price to pay.
Yeah, but still, no indictments, no trials.
They
got to be breathing a sigh of relief.
We want to take a look at a piece of video next that happened from the New York State Senate this week. We're going to take a look at it right now. We'll get your reaction after.
We can agree to disagree on issues, economic issues, my political views, your religious view, or whatever. But when we start name calling people, I have a problem. Senator Gennaris call me and my colleagues are Trump Republican. I would like to remind him that at the end of the day, he's a white man with a degree from Harvard.
There was a colleague here who talked about me and who frankly knows nothing about me. Nothing. She doesn't know that my parents came to this country from Greece. She doesn't know that my father had his home literally burned to the ground by the Nazis and slept in the dirt had to go to school barefoot for months at a time, had to live in post-World War II depression in Greece. And he and my mother got themselves together and came over here as immigrants that we fight for every day to make a life for themselves and to give me the opportunities I have. I'm not embarrassed by the success I've had.
Quite an exchange between two Democrats, one from the IDC, one from the mainline Democrats.
Yeah. The context here is that the mainline Democrats were prevented by the Republican majority from introducing their own one-house budget resolution. However, the IDC, which has some differences with their Republican coalition partners, as they put it, did have the chance to put out their own budget resolution, which the mainline Democrats said was watered down, was no good. So these one-house budget resolutions are purely political documents, little better than sort of debated and voted upon press releases, but the IDC needs the political cover.
And this exchange totally benefits the Republicans, because going back to the trials with U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, they had tapes of former Senate Leader Dean Skelos saying, keep them at each other's throats,
that's
these
right,
two
that's
factions.
Right.
Keep
and
them
that's,
separated.
And that's
yeah.
how we stay in power. And this is just going to increase the bitterness. I mean, how would they ever get together and work together after these like bitter personal insults
going
on?
That seems hard to believe at this point. Yeah. All right, we're going to shift our attention now to Andrew Cuomo. He was in New York City on Thursday celebrating the 30th anniversary of a nonprofit he created called Help USA. Let's take a look.
The formula was take a principled stand, fight for what's right, get results, make a positive difference in people's lives. It's a formula that works for an organization. It's also a formula that works for an individual.
The governor was there to present the Help Hero Humanitarian Award to former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, we went back in the old Inside Albany files, the predecessor to our program, and found the nonprofit's ribbon cutting in the Capital Region from 1988. Dave Hepp is the reporter.
This is not a problem without a solution.
The problem afflicted this mother and child. It is homelessness. Part of the solution, a temporary home for those in transition from the streets to a more permanent place to live, is this 24-unit structure on the outskirts of Albany. It was built by HELP, the name of a nonprofit corporation founded by the governor's son, Andrew. He thanked those who helped him at the dedication this week.
And they will build a facility such as this one, a 15,000-square-foot facility in 6 months, a facility that will provide the homeless with better services and do it at less cost to the taxpayer. We've done it here, we've done it in the city, we're doing it in Suffolk, we're doing it in Westchester, and it is thanks to a public-private sector partnership.
Cuomo hopes to have about 800 units built and running statewide by using government money, that is aid to families with dependent children, and private expertise to own and operate each HELP facility. The land is donated by the local municipality.
For too many years, we took homeless families and warehoused them, in essence, in so-called welfare hotels and motels. We've learned from that experience that that doesn't work, that these are families who have an underlying problem. If everything was going well in their lives, they wouldn't be homeless.
Deborah has two children. She married at age 19 8 years ago. She's been on welfare, and she was burned out of her apartment in August.
That there is some underlying problem that you must address, otherwise you're not going to help these families. And that's what we do here. We help them with the underlying problem on site. You have the daycare, you have the social services necessary to get the family back out on their own, and then you help them find a permanent unit.
What do you think of it?
I like it.
Yeah.
To me, it's great.
Uh-huh.
You know, it gives us a chance to, you know, be independent, be able to do our own things in our own apartment. It helps us with the kids.
Andrew Cuomo gave up a lucrative law practice to devote his full time to help for now. His father noted that.
Now all we need is a son who knows how to make a living. But the
after the speeches and the ribbon cutting, Mrs. Cuomo also took part. Andrew Cuomo acknowledged that given the estimated 30,000 homeless people in New York, that his idea was only a small part of the solution.
David, there is no one answer to the homeless problem. I think if we could do it all over again, take that word homeless and throw it out the window, never use it again, because it's become misleading. Because the homeless population in reality is very diverse, with very disparate problems. You have people with alcohol problems. You have some people who are drug addicts who need help. At the same time, you have people who are homeless only because they don't have a permanent housing unit, only because they can't afford a unit. So you have to go back and address each group's separate individual needs. So there's no one answer, there's no one blanket. There will always be a need for a facility such as this, a transitional facility, because there will always be families who at one point in their lives, for some reason, become homeless and need help getting back out on their own. And that's what this facility does.
Amazing. I mean, what a treasure trove we have. As you found out when you were working on your Mario Cuomo documentary, I mean, that the old footage from those days is really remarkable.
And you can see the 2017 and Andrew Cuomo even back in 1988, very poised with the media, with fellow politicians. That was something to see.
He hasn't changed.
No. All right, we leave you today with a time-lapse video of the massive dumping of snow most of us across the state received this week. This is from the Capital Region. A shout out goes to our videographer extraordinaire, Brian Flynn, who captured it. With Casey Seiler from the Times Union and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio, I'm Matt Ryan. Join us again next week right here on your local PBS station.